One of them wanted to be the security guy. He claimed he was a security guy.
Welcome to a special edition of Security Guy Radio. Doing a little pre-record here for a really important guest. I'm very pleased. Mr. Tony, how you been?
You know, Chuck, I'm doing pretty damn good.
Now, you notice I'm sitting upright without the use of my social prop here for my leg. So the leg is almost good, and I started driving today.
What?
Yeah, back in the saddle.
I'd be afraid if that got stuck or something.
Well, it is a little... I break with my left foot now. Oh, okay. CHP, do not... Listen to this show. You'll want to hear that part. But it's coming. You know, it's been a little long road. We're getting there. Because I got to get ready for Black Hat. Going back to Black Hat.
Are you really?
And somebody we missed at Black Hat was Masergy. And these guys are really cool. They own and operate the largest independent software-defined platform in the world. And they've been around about since 2001.
Wow, long time.
So they've been in the space doing a lot of things with network security. And I thought we'd bring in our special guest today, Mike Studi. Now, we're going to play a video from Masergy first that kind of defines what we do and how they operate, because it's a little, you know, it's for the nieces and nephews, right? We always boil it down to Jarvis and the people that don't get all this stuff, because I want them to get it.
Right.
And
right.
I think so this video will understand, it's about a minute, we'll understand what Masergy does, and we're going to bring Mike on to talk about it, right? So go ahead and roll that video for
all
us.
All right, here we go.
Managing your company's IT security is a pretty tough job, and it's only getting tougher. Every minute of every day, the bad guys are working to breach your defenses. When they succeed, it's a big payday for them and a bigger loss for you. Today's hackers are cyber criminals. They are organized, well-funded, and highly targeted in their efforts. You've spent time, energy, and money building up multiple layers of discrete defenses. But in today's threat landscape, there are simply too many ways those defenses are circumvented. Odds are, you will still get breached. IT security departments can be easily overwhelmed. Excessive alerts, huge data logs, countless false positives, a never-ending remediation list. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. Bottom line. Discrete point solutions alone are insufficient for today's rapidly evolving threat landscape. You need a different approach. Like Masergy's fully managed and unified security solution. Masergy Unified Enterprise Security complements and augments existing security investments with continuous monitoring by security experts and patented network behavioral analysis working together seamlessly. Our patented solution is 100% passive and deployed easily into any network environment and detects, tracks, and correlates even the most minute security events over long periods of time to thwart legitimate threats. Let Masergy find the needles in your haystack. Visit masergy.com/security to sign up for a free security consultation. Masergy, performance beyond expectations.
All right. Did you understand any of that, Tony?
I did, Chuck.
You did. Excellent.
Yeah.
Because we want my people, like one of our fans in Chicago, Pam, or Brian in Florida, who don't understand this. If we want them to understand that, so let's welcome Mike Studi from Masergy. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
Now, Mike's the chief.
How are you guys doing?
Good. Mike's the chief scientist. Where are you calling from, by the way? Back east or somewhere?
You know, I'm actually calling from Florida.
Oh, from Florida. Okay. So you're avoiding the snow. Good for you. Probably a lot of water. We got 6 inches coming tomorrow. We're all a little worried about the rain. So what's really cool about Black Hat and places like Masergy is Mike's a chief scientist. I interviewed a lot of scientists at Black Hat, which is really cool. And some of the sales guys were scientists, right? So they get it. And I want Mike, we saw the video, but give us an overall view of what Masergy does. You guys have been around since at least 2001. You've done a lot of innovations. You've done a lot of patents. You've been first in your space for a lot of things. Give us a real, you know, kind of a one-liner on the value of Masergy and what it does.
One of the nice things that we got to be able to do is we did build our networks. It was a Greenfields project. So instead of connecting a whole bunch of different networks that were acquired or bought or purchased, we get to build it from scratch. And that let us actually do anything and everything we wanted to accomplish our goals of delivery, speed, and security.
So back in the day, we had hierarchy storage management, and you had a dumb computer at your desk. It wouldn't copy anything. You couldn't save stuff on it. It all tied into the computer in the big room down the hall. And now we're back here with this concept, but it's cloud. The cloud is the hierarchy storage management. Your terminal's not dumb. It's also smart and can save things. So what you do, from what I understand it, is Masergy kind of takes the net, the cloud, and stitches together all these different platforms. We might have a network, we might have a cloud, we might have a server, all these different things. And you kind of stitch them together, and then you monitor them and make sure that they're interacting properly and not, you know, there's not a rogue independent threat off on its own. And you do that using a combination of artificial intelligence, human engineering, I suppose, or human analysis, and some automation. Is that a good way to break it down?
Yes, exactly. That is correct. I mean, you do need, you know, both sides of that. I think the I'm always cautious about the word artificial intelligence because, you know, there's a big difference between artificial intelligence and what most people think of, like HAL and, you know, those sort of things in the movies,
right,
versus you know, where we're at now with machine learning. And we're doing some very advanced stuff. But the second part of that is, you know, it is machine learning. And for a machine to learn, you have to have somebody present it with its sample set or what's good, what's bad. So that's where the human side monitoring comes in, at least for now.
Well, I noticed in my Black Hat interviews, a lot of people talked about artificial intelligence. They talk about machine learning. They talk about real time. These are kind of buzzwords in the business that, to the average person, when they hear it, thinks it means what it means, but it doesn't exactly mean a common definition. Define machine learning from artificial intelligence for people. I understand the machine learning to be the machine is learning your rules that you either program into it, or it can actually go out and learn rules based upon behavior of the network and patterns on the network. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah, it is. It's really called feature learning. So, you know, you're talking about a lot of data, you know, a lot of data, and of course, well, it's very interesting kind of how, you know, my career's gone, because when I started doing this, my job as a data scientist was to analyze data, look at data, find, you know, the relationships and the correlations of that data, and then find a way to, you know, be able to detect that. Okay, so that's kind of how it went. And then as we progressed, the machines got faster. You know, neural networks have been around for a long time. We're actually, you know, in our third generation of neural networks now. Almost everybody's using second generation, and there's a pretty big difference between the two. But the goal of this is, now instead of me looking at data and saying, oh, I see the correlation, you know, that happens, which causes this, I now have some data structures that are very good at finding that for me. So if I can look through and find features and feed features into a data structure, what it can do for me now is find those things that are very difficult, you know, for me to find. And that's why it's called feature learning. And machine learning really is that. It is that feature learning piece to be able to say, I've got a data structure, I've got data, and it can find things that I can't. And that's the beauty of that.
So feature learning is a smaller subset of machine learning? It's like the really
specific
thing?
Well, I think machine learning is really more around the science of that.
So, oh, okay.
A lot of different ways we can, or a lot of different networks. You know, you've got convolutional neural networks and recurrent neural networks and feedforward and all these. And those are different ways to look at that data. But what they're really doing is feeding features. I think a good one, you're familiar with AlphaGo, correct?
No, go ahead. Tell us.
Okay, AlphaGo is Google's DeepMind computer that was designed to play the game Go. And it's very interesting that they picked Go because, you know, we've beaten chess. I mean, there's a program called Stockfish now that you can download. It's an open source program that you can pretty much handicap it and take its pieces away, and it'll still be, it's that good nowadays.
Wow.
But chess is a very small, you know, board. It's a very small, you know, 64 spaces and limited sets of motion and movement. Go, on the other hand, is very intuitive. It's a very large board, and it's more about kind of visualizing where attacks are coming from and and where do I need to defend? Where am I weak? Where am I strong? So for a long time, people said, well, it'll be forever before computers are good at playing Go. The AlphaGo computer is DeepMind's work from Google, and they actually took on a nine-don player. He's, you know, the best in the world, basically. Lee Sedol was his name. And in the matches, you know, they beat him 4 out of 5. They whipped him, and the only reason they lost one is they made one little mistake he was able to capitalize on. So, you know, we're getting there to that point where you start to say we're closing that gap between machine learning and artificial intelligence. But when it comes down to what AlphaGo is it's a bunch of different networks that are all learning certain things, certain features, and then plugging those into another, you know, algorithm that says, I'm going to take the best move and so forth. So it seems very, very intelligent, and it actually is very intelligent. But when it comes right down to it, it really is just data in still.
That's fascinating. I had a talk with Carl Herberger. He's with Radware. He's pretty well known in the business discussing things like this. And we talked about artificial intelligence, and he said that somebody did the math and claimed that in about 25 years or so, maybe a little less, the network would become self-aware. And meaning that, like you just talked about, you know, that for that Go program, it goes out and looks for solutions and analyzes it. And the network would say, okay, I have a command. I'm supposed to go turn off Chuck's lights at his house. And now I get to Chuck's house and I can't turn them off because something happened. I'm just going to go as a computer or network, go out and look for some code that allows me to complete my task. Because in theory, all code that's ever been written could be written one day. It's only so many combinations of letters and ones and zeros, right? And then it fills in the code itself. And that is kind of a definition of artificial intelligence when it goes out and acts upon its own. And he called it self-awareness of the network. I thought it was kind of interesting that they think it's coming so fast. So they hear about this Google thing is it's a little scary, but I'm glad people are watching it. What do you think about that? Do you think we're getting close to self-awareness on the network?
You know, I think that's a very interesting question. We kind of move from machine learning. The next step up is specialized artificial intelligence, which is a vertical. You know, AlphaGo is exactly that. I would say it's probably our first artificial intelligence program that is, you know, and its vertical is playing the game of Go. But it actually shows intelligence. I mean, anybody that plays it knows that. Now, they just recently, I think it was last week, I was reading about this, and they took that same concept and they were playing professional poker players. And, you know, poker is a little bit different, right?
Right.
I mean, the Go game, you just look at the board and you can kind of figure out where am I? Whereas poker, you're dealing with, you know, you're dealing with bluffing, you're dealing with people's facial expressions and things like that. Well, they actually, you know, beat all the professional poker players. I think the thing cleaned them out, you know, won $10 million
wow.
or something like that in some tournament. You know, so we're starting to get into that. But once again, it's not what you would call a general artificial intelligence. It's not HAL, you know, or Jarvis,
right.
You know, it specializes in this one thing. And I think what he's talking about is when you get to that point where, you know, really what is self-awareness? And there's a lot of, you know, research into this, everything from psychology to, you know, neurology and neuroscience. But it really is a difference knowing that I am an individual and I'm capable of, you know, doing things that I choose to do, whether that's good or bad, you know, and I think that's it. So he was saying he thinks within 25 years, we'll hit that self-aware. And I really think that that's the long pole, actually.
Oh.
To me, seeing the advances that we thought we would get to you know, we said we'd be able to play Go well, probably around the time frame of 20 to, you know, 25.
Oh.
Here we're already doing it. You know, we're way early, and then the poker player comes along behind. We already have, you know, something can now look at a medical system and look at radiology. Can it's pretty much been replaced by artificial intelligence or machine learning because they can look at the graphs, they can look at the MRIs and the X-rays, and be able to diagnose. And they're already starting to diagnose things just by looking at those that radiologists themselves are missing.
Now, it's interesting you should say that. This is at least 20, oh, maybe 20, 25 years ago. I went to a place called HealthView, and there's a guy named Dr. Eisner, and he was piloting a program for Congress that was, he was building the Star Trek medical ward, right, where you scan the body, it takes pictures and tells you what's going on. And he was commissioned to build this. And so I go to him about every 5 years. And he does a complete body scan, and this was the technology that turned your your MRI into a 3D image, and he could colorize it and take your heart apart and say, hey, look inside, you got plaque and stuff, right? And now that seemingly, you know, brilliant technology back in the day has exponentially come forward to where he has collected so much data and done so many body scans, right? Tens of thousands of them. The computer can say, that thing right there on an MRI means this. That means cancer. And he scans for something like 20 cancers. And it's pretty, you know, pretty almost 100% accurate that says that that image means that. So this all gets back to, you know, everything becoming, turning onto the internet. I remember when I was driving home one day as a young policeman, some guy came on the radio from a place called Google, some young kid, and said, what's your business model, kid? Oh, we're going to put everything on the internet. And the internet was like, you know, 1985. It wasn't even, you know. And I ran home and I said, we got to buy stock in this company called Google. They're going to put everything on the internet. And my wife said, well, that's not possible. I said, it's not possible now, right? So it's just amazing how exponentially it's moving forward. And I'm just worried, Mike, that it's going to go fast forward so much, we're going to lose control of it, right? I mean, that's something where we might have a problem with, but it's fascinating. So tell me how Masergy gets a handle on this. You know, back in the day, we had a guy at the studio. He was the IT guy. He had a Windows, .NET platform certificate. He could run things on your computer. He could take care of viruses and stuff. That's all gone. And now it's outsourcing. And one major corporation may have, you know, five different networks or platforms they use for different things. And Masergy is going to tie these things all together. So explain to me how that works in a kind of a practical sense.
Okay. Well, we are obviously providing one of the things we can do is provide, you know, worldwide communications. One of the amazing things we can do with our network that I absolutely love is, you know, we can actually promise with an SLA less than 1% jitter. So you can do video, you can do audio, you can do all that from pretty much any POP in the world, any other POP in the world. We can guarantee that delivery. But the other nice thing about that is, since we have that infrastructure, one of the things we can do is we're moving a lot of data. We're moving a lot of our customers' data. So we can go all the way out into the customer, and we can install a piece of our system there that says, all right, let's watch the local. Okay, we can watch your local firewalls, your local switches, workstations, and then as you move into the cloud, you know, we can also watch your traffic as it moves across the world. So we can cover all of that. And you kind of mentioned the doctor, which I think was very astute, because really what's going on there is he's saying, I've got a system that reads MRIs, and then really what it needed was data. And I think another great example of that is, Google image searching now.
Oh, yeah.
You can do a Google image search down to, it was kind of fun the other day, I was showing somebody, I think I did golf balls in the snow. And sure enough, that's what pops up, right? Golf balls in the snow. And then you change it to gold balls in the snow, and boom, that's the very next thing. So, you know, it's gotten down to where you can do very, very detailed sort of searches, and that's largely because they've just been absorbing all the pictures on the internet and everything that we take with our phones and upload, and it goes into Google Cloud. They've looked at and they've labeled it and said that's a dog and so forth. So over time, just like the doctor, they've seen so much stuff that we now are identifying it. And really, that's the Masergy approach to security as well. You need a lot of data. A lot of these things, you know, we're talking about nation states, and I have seen some of the most sophisticated things. You know, I mean, we've got the Equation Group, aka the NSA, that has, you know, we're all calling it malware, but if you actually analyze it and look at it, it's really not malware. It's a whole platform designed to be able to go out and get new pieces, and, you know, so it's a whole attack platform that's being installed, and it's doing so in such a stealthy way.
Wow. So there's somebody's renting a building and hooking up a data center, and all that data center does is attack. It's not some guy in his basement anymore with a piece of code he's trying to sneak into a public source or something. It's that sophisticated. That's kind of scary, but it's amazing.
No, it absolutely is. I mean, it has actually come to that. Warfare is the very first case we do. Sometimes politics, too. You know, it's on the wire now.
Right.
We start there.
So let's talk about what's going on in politics now. I'm not naming names or parties. We just know it's all a big mess on both sides, right? And we're talking about things have been hacked. They throw that around loosely. You know, things aren't really hacked. You just leave your encrypted key somewhere in a directory and somebody finds it. They're not doing a brute force attack on things. I'm more worried about the lack of a human element analyzing these things. And Masergy takes some scientists and plugs them into this, where it's not just the, you know, artificial learning. It's actually some human being saying, you know what, the machine is giving me an alert, but I'm going to analyze that further. Talk about how you guys handle that piece. I think that's so important. And the reason I say this is because back in the day, when I was in physical security at the studios, the IT department never talked to us. We never talked to the IT department. Now people have started to hire IT guys to be in charge of IT and physical security. And I think that's a mistake. I think they're two disciplines that need to work together to solve these kind of things. You need a people element and the technology element.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, one of the hardest things to find is good security guys. I mean, they're in great demand. So with the machine learning and the ability to learn, I mean, it all is, no matter what we like, it still goes back to that old Deagle principle, right? Garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
So you have to be able to present the machine with what you want it to learn, or it will be just like us. It will learn the bad habits that you don't want it to learn. So, we have a room full, I mean, a very large team of guys. And then these guys are, very smart. Their whole goal is, we obviously have the network side of the fence, and we have that team over there, but we also have the security side of the fence, and they're completely separate. And their goal on the security side is exactly that. Okay, so the machine has said this or presented us, and sometimes the machine can't do any better than say, this is kind of like your medical, right? This is unusual. I don't know what it is. I don't know what to call it, but it's abnormal. And so that's when those guys have to go in and start tearing that apart and taking a look at it and going, okay, all right, we've identified what it is and we know the steps that it took. So now we can teach the machine that so that it can do it next time. And, you know, not to mention the whole purpose of security is, you know, if it were just about detection, if you just detected it and said, oh, great, I've detected it, it's solved. It's never that easy, right? You have to turn around now and say, okay, well, how do I defend against it? Is it a firewall change? Do I need to upgrade a switch? Do I need to reconfigure something? So there's that human side of that is very often, you know, you're going to deal with a lot of different networks. You said it yourself. Everybody has a different network. In fact, everybody has five different networks now. And so you need some guys in there that understand not only the security side of it, but will say, all right, here's what we found, and here's what you need to solve it, you know, and that's a different solution for everybody. So that's why they're so important.
Now, how do they interact with the client on that level? Because like you said, a lot of companies come out and they do identification. We have an alert. Real-time used to mean a month. Now real-time means, you know, maybe real-time means an hour now. Maybe real-time means real-time. But if the human factor, the scientists over at Masergy aren't picking up the phone and calling Tony at the studio saying, Tony, your radio show has been hacked and we got a problem going on, then it's just not going to work. So how does it nuts and bolts work with the human interaction and your client?
Right. Well, I guess we call it a document, although almost everything's electronic now, right? Which is exactly how we do that. It's basically how do we do incident response with a customer? And it lets you, the customer, define it. So you could say, all right, we have four separate priorities, everything from, you know, the very serious happened all the way down to, hey, this might be worth taking a look at if we get enough of them. How do you want us to respond? So when we get a P1, who are we going to call? Are we going to call? Or are we going to email? What are we doing? You know, and it could be in very often cases, you know, obviously our system can program your switches, can program firewalls. So maybe your decision is cut it off immediately first, you know, surgically. Don't shut me down, but let's stop that. And then let's talk about what we can do. So you have the whole gambit of, and you know, a lot of customers they take the other side. Don't do anything to my network until you've talked to me first.
Right.
But you get to define that. It's a custom method, you know, person A, person B, person C. When A doesn't answer, I want you to call B three times using this number, then twice this, if that fails, and so forth. So you get to define exactly how that is. And then instead of it being, you got a problem, glad we let you know, see you later.
That's right.
It's going to be like, okay, hey, here's what we recommend. Here's our first thing. You know, it could be sometimes it simply is, hey, it's new to us too. So we want to block this, the firewall. Let's have us a little time to let our guys take a look at it, and then we can come back with a better solution for you.
So you guys are operating
all the way from that.
You're giving a turnkey solution, where some companies
absolutely
are just saying, I identified it. I got to go to lunch now. I'll see you later. You guys take care of it. Now,
yep.
Let's talk about the knowledge gap. So as you said, and a friend of mine has a cyber placement company. She hires cyber people. She says there's a shortage of about 1 million people that they cannot find to fill these jobs. It's that bad. The knowledge base, right? I mean, you know, oh, I know Windows NT. Well, sorry, that's a little old. We can't really use you anymore. So you need to find people to fill those jobs to do that analysis. But are you finding a, I don't know how I would describe it. My parents didn't raise any dumb kids, but you guys are in a stratosphere of knowledge and intellect that's way beyond average people. Would you say that the private sector has now shifted to a company like yourself that has the scientists and the outsource and the data? Now, when you interact with a client, are you finding a knowledge gap between you, your business, and a client? In other words, I don't know, you know, UBN Radio, who has hired you, doesn't have a scientist on staff, doesn't really get all this stuff, but trusts you to do it for them. Are you finding that delays responses or interferes with a proper response?
Well, you know, it can sometimes, but the goal with it being is, you know, down there at that bottom level, it shouldn't be about the science behind it. It should be more about the actionable steps that you can take.
Okay.
Now, sometimes, you know, where it does interfere is, right, it's like, okay, we need more information. This is something going on. We don't have all the pieces. Maybe we need more from you. Can you go do this? Or can you? That might be the situation where we run into a problem where you don't have quite, you know, the person that you need. But in general, we end up, you know, getting that out. And customers are, and I don't blame them. If you can stop it and you've done that and you don't learn maybe everything you could, I'm still a happy customer. So we have to accept that sometimes. That's just the way it is.
Talk to me about a company like Masergy and how you guys are attacked. I'm assuming the protectors are now having to protect themselves first as they protect other people. Are you guys, not your company specifically, but companies like yours, are they new targets? In other words, if I can take Masergy down, I'm taking down all 100 of their clients.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think the answer to that is it should be pretty obvious to anybody in the business that yes, indeed. In fact, you know, it's kind of interesting, the video, I love the video that you started with, which is ours, talks about the, you know, the cyber criminal aspect of
right.
it. And that is certainly a very large aspect of what's going on. But right now, the biggest problem that we as security professionals face in this world are the nation states, because they have billion-dollar budgets, right? In fact, they don't really have budgets. They
right.
just have goals.
Goals, right.
Know? Yeah, so it's a lot harder for us because of that. It's a lot more sophisticated. And what those guys are interested in doing, you know, they don't necessarily want to break in to steal things. I mean, that never hurts. I mean, if you're if my good guys are your bad guys and so forth. So, you know, information is certainly powerful. But more importantly, can I break in and just lie low and sit there and wait until I need you for some purpose? Okay, so a lot of them are breaking in, not just telco companies, but, you know, other infrastructure, power plants, you know, anything from bank, you know, financial processing or clearinghouses, mortgages, all of those. If they can just break in, it's not necessarily always about information. It's about, say, can I get in and get a foothold? And no matter what you do, when you re-image your system and you re-upload or you upgrade the operating system, I want to make sure I'm still there so that when I need you, you know, you're there for me. And that's really the toughest, because they're really wanting to be super stealthy about this. They want to have very low communication. So I want to get in, and then I want to have my agent just sit there and do nothing, but I need a way to tell it to do what I want it when I want it to. And that's the toughest part about this.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I'm kind of a, you know, amateur writer, and I have a big imagination, and I come up with things all the time ever since I was a kid. And when computers first came out, I had my first computer in 1984. There were two floppy drives. And I used to build my own computers, and I know a lot about it. I'm no genius at it, but I know more than most people do. And I always thought to myself, listen, if I'm some rogue nation and I'm a bad guy. Oh, by the way, did you ever meet Mike, Tony, my friend Mike? He's a computer programmer.
I don't think so.
So he said, I'm glad you can't write code, Chuck, because if you could, you'd be very dangerous, right? Because I can think of all kinds of crazy stuff. One crazy thing I came up with is, let's say I'm a super evil genius, right? What I would do is just what you said, Mike. I would just spend years, I might spend 10, 15 years getting into every single network I can and every single bank and every single government infrastructure. And I just sit there And then one day I'd push the button and I'd turn everything off simultaneously. And if I turn it off for 5 minutes, everything would collapse. I don't have to turn it off for a day or a week. I can just turn off everything in the government for one day. What a mess. And this is what I worry about, right? I worry about the grid going down. There was a successful attack on a grid in Ukraine or something, or some Russian area last year, that they took a little town down. That was a nation state, I think they did, right? So, Mike, is there a tin can and a wire? I always tell people on the physical side of security, make sure you have a tin can and a wire, because all your hyper, super duper technical stuff is great, but you still need some water. You still need a blanket. You need to be able to start fire. You got to get to basics. In the cyber world, what is a tin can and a wire? Where, worst case scenario, do you just turn everything off and leave it off for a week, and then they can't get in there, and you fix it offline and then bring it back up? I'm just throwing out some crazy ideas of mine.
No, I've got you. And you know, I have those same thoughts. And especially when we're talking about how, you know, for me to teach a computer what I want and for it to get smarter, I need less and lots of data, you know, having that agent sit there. But I think, you know, some of the documents that were leaked by Snowden, if you look at those, okay, there's this whole thing called the ANT, okay, that the NSA has, and that is the type of group that is designed, to gain access. It's the, the Office of Tactical Access Operations, TOA, and their goal is to get access. That's their goal. And so they came up with these catalogs of things and various pieces of hardware and software. And Snowden did release some of those. And some of the ones really surprised me. You should look it up sometime.
I will.
One of the ones that got me... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm going to look that up. Go ahead. That's very interesting.
Oh, okay. One of them was this thing called Firewalker. Okay, so Firewalker is a USB and 2 gig Ethernet port that it's the female side of it. It's the side you plug into, okay? And it's a little tiny, you know, it looks just like any component sitting on your computer motherboard. But what it really did was any information that crossed either of those ports, so your network cable, your USB that you plugged in, was transmitted by radio to someplace else.
Oh.
And not only could it transmit by radio, but it could receive information, so it could implant information.
I remember hearing something about this. Yeah, that's scary.
Okay. Oh, yeah, and there's, you know, there's computers that are, a whole ARM-based computer with FPGA that's programmable that's smaller than a penny. In fact, we even have, you know, multi-layer computers. I was just talking about doing a speech on them the other day. It's about 7 or 8 layers of a computer, and it's about 3 millimeters by 2.5, and it's a fully capable GPU-based type of neural network that can do stuff like that. So these things are getting very small. So I think the ultimate scare situation is you have to wonder, where are we manufacturing electronics in
yes.
the world? And we don't do it here, right? It's right. not here at all. It's overseas. So what if some component that you think is a little resistor, one of those itty-bitty tiny bullets that we call resistors now, or maybe there's a little 3x3 millimeter chip on your motherboard. You have no idea what it's for. I mean, who would? Is somebody going through each and every one of those and verifying that every component on that piece of hardware is supposed to be there and is really doing what it is? Or is there some component over there that's basically you fly over with an airplane with the right kind of signal and boom, everything goes off just like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. No, so, I hear you.
So
that's
the ultimate, right?
Yeah. I mean, I in the 80s, there was a joke going around that if Russia wanted to, this is during the Cold War, right? And I don't know if it was a joke or it was actually something real, because I had a friend of mine who was in the aerospace manufacturing and made screws and bolts, right? And he said, look, if they wanted to defeat us, they go out and buy all the aerospace parts companies, and they make a bunch of inferior nuts and bolts. And in 5 or 6 years, every nut and bolt and widget and rivet would just fall off airplanes and fall off tanks and fall off everything. They'd break. They'd shear. And then everything would fall apart. This is very similar, right? And we see this already. So I got a Samsung. And by the way, here it is, Samsung, my Note 5, which I'm really pissed off about, because I went from Verizon to T-Mobile. And the freaking thing doesn't really work well because Samsung puts on this motherboard a bunch of Verizon crap, and I can't get rid of it. All right. Now, this is very similar to what Mike's talking about. There's some chip on there, it's not really software, I don't think. I think it's some kind of, you know, part that everything pops up Verizon all the time, and I'm using T-Mobile network. So, and then wasn't it, Mike, wasn't it Lenovo or some company that the government went out and bought a whole bunch of computers from? This is a couple years ago. And it was on the list that said, don't buy these computers because the manufacturer, I think it was in China, had put on that motherboard some kind of a chip that activated games and pop-ups and all these kind of things, which in essence became an app that allowed you to get into the computer. And I'm not sure it was malicious per se, except that they wanted you to play their games, right? But that was that was a big, terrible breach that nobody caught.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's an actual case of exactly. And like you said, it seemed innocent enough, right? We just wanted to play games, but in reality, it was a full backdoor into the system. I mean, it's just the way it is. It's a scary world in that aspect. And so from the security side of things, that's why the information is going to be so important. And I think we're also going to shift from let's detect stuff moving, through switches and routers and things like that. We're also going to have to start addressing signal warfare, which is what's in the air around us too. That's going to be a very important piece of this as well.
I had a case back in the 80s, I think it was, late 80s. Guy hired me because stuff kept getting stolen from his business. We traced it back to his house. And what had happened is some guy was sitting in his car outside his house in Beverly Hills and picking up the radio waves from the screen. And so he could actually somehow read the screen sitting in his car. I don't remember the technology involved, but it had something to do with waves and things like that. And this is back in the late 80s, right? So this stuff's been going on a long time. Is there anything, Mike, anything that can detect those sort of hardware components? Anybody working on that?
Oh, yeah, there is. And then if you go back to that ant catalog I talked about, that type of thing you're talking about there is called Tempest.
Right.
That is where you're going to read the every electronic piece that you produces a radio wave as the skates move, And so what they're doing is they're reading that radio signal. A great analogy is, I don't know if you've ever seen any of these videos where a guy has programmed like a stepper motor to actually rotate at the proper frequency to play a song.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just a motor and it's just turning, but because it does it at the right speed and the right rate, we go, hey, I know that song, that's Michael Jackson's Beat It or something.
Right.
And so this is similar. You've got these gates turning on or off, and it's actually creating radio waves outbound from the system. And in the ant catalog, they have, here's the device you use to, I'll tell you, one of my favorites is called a radar reflector. And a radar reflector is a little tiny circuit. I mean, it is just a few transistors, perfectly small. And they have a monitor cable, the cable that goes between your monitor and your video card. And you get this little tiny circuit in it. If you could peel open your cable and look, you'd see it. It's actually just connected between one of the wires there. And what they can do is they hit it with continuous scanning radar. And what it causes is then any data that moves across that wire changes the radar reflection so that when it goes back to them, they know whether it's on or off. And then they have a device that starts, looking at the signal to go, well, can I piece that back together and put your screen? Oh, yeah, sure enough, there's the horizontal and vertical refresh, and boom, there's your screen. And they're doing this from radar. So I don't know yet of any companies. I'm going to say I haven't really heard any companies that are producing things to do that. You have to have a radar detector in that case. I mean, that's a tough thing to have. But I'm sure they're out there, and I'm sure that the very people that have created the offensive side probably have that defensive side as well. Are we going to get to the point where every machine has a built-in Faraday cage or something?
So at Black Hat, I did about 50 shows. And after every show, I felt really good about the show, or I felt really bad about the show. Like, I either had the crap scared out of me and we're all doomed, or I felt this company's got a handle on it and we're safe, right? So with Mike, with you, I'm kind of in the middle. I'm kind of like, Master G's protecting it, but Mike's up against some stuff that, wow, what do we do about it, right? Because your knowledge certainly is there and your product is there. But boy, some of these things are just, it's beyond comprehension,
It is, Still the easiest way, though, is you got to remember, the easiest way in right now is the human sitting in front of the computer.
It still is, right?
So,
yeah, that's 80% or something.
That's a conventional method using your network to communicate with. So 85% of everything that's going to happen to you, probably more like 90, is going to involve that person, your own network, and your own communication. So being able to monitor that and analyze and watch that is still the number one way to protect yourself, at least for now. When you start talking about those other techniques where somebody's outside with a radar, you're probably in a world of trouble more than you know anyway when somebody's doing that.
Exactly.
So that's a completely different situation.
So I guess when I was a cop, I should not have made fun of those people that had tin foil on their head. I think they were onto something. they may have been. So I have the girl that lives in my house who has a BSN, Bachelor of Science in Nursing, pretty smart kid that cost $200,000 for her education, decides she's going to open up an email that's from Bank of America talking about her account. And, of course, our entire home network got infected, and I got hacked or whatever you want to call it, right? Big mess. Then they got into Facebook. What did you open that for? Well, I thought it might be important. I said, do you have an account with Bank of America? No. Have we ever had an account with Bank of America? No. Why didn't you just delete it? It's this curiosity factor. People cannot help but click on things. You want people to ignore something, say, don't push this button. And if you say this button's going to destroy the earth, don't push it, people will push it. It's over 80%.
Yeah, exactly.
It's crazy. It's a psychology, and the guys know this kind of stuff. It's really pretty amazing to me. So what is Mesergy working on now? You had a lot of milestones. I went through your milestone chart there from 2001. You have a lot of patents that your company has invented on stuff. You've had the world's largest network, I think. Talk to me about how, I forgot what it was described, how you manage networks through software. Is this where you're bringing it down to, it used to be that only the IT guy up in the closet could run things. And your platform allows, not an average person, but somebody that wants to get in there can manipulate the network and look at security issues and kind of monitor it in real time using your software interface. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you think about what we traditionally think of as hardware, all your big switches and all those big boxes with all those wires and ports hanging in the back, that can all be reduced now into software. Now, you still have a lot of the wires and you still have a lot of the hardware components, but really, instead of it being, a computer that's specifically designed to handle packets, it's actually you started the show with it. It's that old, we've got a great big computer running multiple copies of other computers, and each one of those is individual. So we can,
right.
It can be your firewall, it can be your switch, it can be your closet switch. And now the routing is actually occurring through a virtual software link, right? It's not actually coming out of wire and going back into another box. So that allows you to easily go in there and get the information you need to do security, or easily go in and say, I misjudged how much the art department needed for bandwidth, so all I had to do was go in and change this dial over, and now they get another 17 ports worth of data they didn't have before, and problem solved. I'm back to work, and I'm done. So
yeah.
That's exactly what software definition lets you do.
Now, I had one of the people on the show, and forgive me for not knowing the technical vernacular, but this sort of software, to protect it on your network, is operated inside a cage, box, what is that term? In other words, you surround the software inside the network with this protective layer, so people can't even find it or get into it. Is that what is that called?
Well, there's a couple of different techniques for that. I mean, a lot of it is called, it is just called a box. Like one of the popular ones is called boxes, and basically it's just a hypervisor, which is a very simple operating system, and then each one of those is a virtual machine, and those virtual machines then obviously are wrapped by in this box.
Right.
And what it is, it's a sandbox, right?
Sandbox,
so, that machine can only live and exist in there, and it thinks it is the world, but really what it is it's actually running. It's kind of the Matrix idea, right? You're actually running on something else. You think you're a system, and you think you own all of memory and all of this, but in reality, none of that exists because I'm in complete control of it, and I can change it anytime I want. So that's what it is.
You mentioned earlier in the show how we're into the third generation of neural networks. And you say most people are still in the second one, but you guys are in the third. Explain that to everybody.
Yeah. Well, the second generation, I mean, we go all the way back to neural networks have been around for a long time. But the hardware requirements were pretty difficult. So it took a while, in the early 80s, we started getting much better at it because we got better hardware and better techniques. But, everything we think of now is generally what's called a feed-forward network. So you have a set of inputs and some layers inside there, belief layers and all these things you can read about. But what it is, it's a set of very simple neurons that have an activation feature. And you put your data in one side, you activate all the neurons, and you get an output. And your output is what you read. And that's your class, or if you're doing unsupervised learning, it's your feature set, or et cetera. But they're really only based on neurons in the fact that, I've got an input and I'm connected to other things. I pass my input through some function to something else. And that's kind of, connectivity. Now, I did a lot of work when I was doing my master's degree, which was in molecular biology. I did a lot of work in neuroscience, which is studying those structures in the brain. It was absolutely fascinating. I mean, to me, I thought it was just amazing. And so a third generation neural network is very much more like a biological neuron. The way we actually encode information is the firing rate. So it's spatiotemporal. It is both the presence in time as well as, the frequency of it. So
right.
If you think about a good old EKG from your heart going up and down, you have both the amplitude, how far does it go up, and how often does it go. And so those are the two dimensions. And the third generation neural network actually has much more like our own biological neurons. They're much more heavily connected, and they actually are based on that rate. So input is not just let me drop a value and then let the network operate. You actually have to operate it very much like that. You put in your data, on, off, on, on, off, off, on a certain sequence, and that is a different set of input than to the network than to something that's entirely different. So what's neat about a third generation or a spiking neural network is what it's called, is they are time-based by their very nature. So when you're talking about doing streaming data like a network or video or something like that, we're not taking a snapshot and putting the data in. You're actually letting that stream feed the neural network. And then what you're reading on the other side of that neural network is, how does it react? Is it in an alpha pattern, a beta, all these different ways? What does it do? And that's the difference with third generation neural networks. They're much more, they're highly complicated. They're a lot harder to train, but they are great for doing streaming data.
So that's why UPN looks so good now. The show, because it is. Remember when we first started doing this kind of stuff, it was choppy, and now you can't even tell the difference. So I remember, I forget where I heard this, but it's none of those useless pieces of information floating around in my head. But a hard drive can only spin so fast, and then it's going to melt because the heat is going to melt it, right? And so there gets a point, and I forgot who, there's a scientist that came up with this name, and it's something where eventually hard drives will melt. They won't be able to go any faster than they go. We won't be able to make the next chip for the self-driving car. We won't be able to, have flying cars and spaceships because we can't crunch the numbers fast enough with the old computers to go to the next level. And then one theory is everything stops, and then we just have a Samsung Note 5 for the rest of our life. That's it. They can't make a new one. Or we go backwards. And I forgot what that's called. It's like, the Kennedy...
It's a principle.
What do you think about that? I mean, we're getting to biological computers eventually, right? We're going to have we have to have biological computers because they won't go fast enough, regular ones.
Yeah, a human neuron takes actually about 5 milliseconds or so before it's ready to fire again. So when you talk about how we think our biological meter, it's actually not very fast.
It's not, right?
I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
5 second cycle time to be able to ready to go again. But the difference is it's massively parallel, right? Absolutely massively parallel. And your brain doesn't process information like we think. We tend to think of brain as like a program, and it does this and manipulates. It's not that way at all. It's just this seemingly random bunch of signals and firings and your eyes, when you're looking at black, you fire at a high rate, and you're looking at white, your neurons in your retina are barely firing. So it's these very simple things like that, but it's highly complicated and all goes together. I think what's going to happen is this, and it goes back to that, the Jarvis idea or the Hal idea. We're going to create a first set of computers that are going to be smarter than us. And that doesn't mean they're self-aware. That just means that they have more access to data and more access to the relationships of those data that they can then basically say, all right, here's how I was made. If you would make me, or if you would reprogram me this way, I would be faster and smarter and able to load more data. And so if we make those changes, that then leads to it maybe saying, here's a new idea for hardware and so forth, to the point where now you have achieved that exactly what you're talking about, that point where the machine is actually able to not only say, here's the software changes I need, but let me do it myself. And if you think about a computer how we run computers, and we have lines of code, and they're sequential, and we have jump points and all these things. A machine, if you think you could rewrite your whole body anytime you want to do something new, you need to say, well, I need to jump a little further, so I'll reconfigure, move the muscles from my arm into my legs and jump. I mean, it seems like sci-fi, but when you're talking about software, just like we were talking about software-defined networks, when you're talking about software, that very thing can occur. So a computer programming itself would be very, very different than I think we can even conceive of the way it would work. And that, I think, is, you know, you can't outdo the physical limitations. So, you know, an electron can only move so fast, and a light can only travel so fast. But that is how you are going to achieve and actually eke out every last bit of performance that the physical world has to offer. And I think it's a lot further. When you're talking about spintronics and storing data in the spin of electrons, you know, one atom can hold, you know, reams and reams of data than we can even imagine today. And, you know, those are the sort of things that are still available and open to us.
Mike Studi, Chief Scientist for Mastergy.com. Mike, my little security guy radio brain is starting to shut down with these concepts because it's too daunting to think about, but it's scary. It's fascinating. I feel good now because Mike is a smart guy and he's a chief scientist, and Mastergy's coming up with some solutions for this stuff. So people are paying attention to it. Fascinating show, Mike. Very good. You got anything coming up? Are you going to be a black hat or any other places you want to mention where Mastergy is going to be?
Yeah, we will definitely be a black hat next year for sure. I mean, I think that's you know, obviously the banner event. And we are actually at RSA this week. I'm not there myself,
yeah,
but we are there. And you can certainly stop by and talk to us while you're there.
Excellent. Mike, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Mastergy.com is the best place to start. Get all the information for this. And you're welcome anytime. I mean, you know, you just give us a call and say, hey, something else just changed in the world, and let's talk about it. You're welcome to come on the show anytime you want.
All right, we'll do.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot. Mr. Tony, did you learn something today? Pretty scary stuff, huh?
I did. Yeah, it is kind of after a while, you're like, overload of information that us humans can't.
It makes that new computer you look like a piece of junk that you just bought compared to all the stuff they're talking about.
Yeah, when he said a computer is smarter than me, I'm like, that's not going to take me too much.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of interesting if you actually look at the numbers. Not only are we talking about a computer smarter than an individual human, that's kind of hard for us to conceive. I mean, I think the data scientists know it's just a matter of time. I give it 7 to 10 years. But after that, imagine a computer smarter than all of us. All of us.
Combined knowledge.
In the world.
Yeah.
That is projected right now to be somewhere around the 2040, 2045. That's in our lifetimes.
I'll be in my compound by then.
Yeah.
Off the grid. Yeah. All right, Mike. Thanks for coming on Security Guy Radio. Until next
right,
week,
we'll
tune in next Monday on Security Guy Radio. Right. Thanks for tuning in. Good night.
Bye-bye.